read, read books, books. Read, read books, books. Read, read books, books. Hold them in your hand, and you'll hippity hoppity clippity cloppity off to a different land.
I love this segment of the show so much. It's our book pick segment, and we here's what we do. We get two wonderful booksellers from our region, and they come in and they tell us about all the really cool books that are in their store shelves that we should know about. Some are new, some are old, some are for kids, some are for adults, all over the place. And it's a wonderful opportunity to see all the good stuff that is out there, and we are blessed, absolutely blessed, with having some of the finest, if not the finest, independent bookstores in our region. And it's just a treasure. And we get to open up that treasure chest every week and find out what is going on. So let me introduce you to James Conrad from the Golden Notebook in Woodstock, New York. Hello, James.
Hello. Nice to see you, Joe.
Very nice to see you. And Lily Bartels is from Open Door Bookstore in Schenectady. Good morning.
Hi there.
Really nice to have you here. All right, let us begin. Go, Lily.
I am going to start with the new book by Ron Chernow, Mark Twain. And as we all know, Chernow has won the Pulitzer Prize for his biographies, which are vast. And as you can see, this is quite the tome. I've brought a copy with me.
Damn, that's big.
He's probably best known for his biography of Alexander Hamilton, on which Lin-Manuel Miranda based the musical Hamilton. But he's also done biographies of Ulysses S. Grant. He's done Samuel Adams, George Washington, and others. And now he's giving readers his latest, Mark Twain. This will likely stand as the definitive account of Twain's work and life for many years. He begins by talking about Twain's upbringing in Missouri, and he makes the interesting suggestion that Twain's sense of humor and his lifelong aversion to authority developed as a reaction to his very stern father. He also delves into the making of Twain's classic works, and he describes how at one point Twain was so frustrated with Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which he had not finished, that he considered throwing the manuscript into the fire, which he thankfully did not do. And then he went all in on completing it. This is kind of a warts and all biography. So he does delve into some of Twain's contradictions and some of his problematic behaviors. He was very big on calling out the robber barons of the Gilded Age, while at the same time he never ceased trying to amass his own fortune. In his earlier life, he expressed a sort of casual racism, which he evolved out of as his life progressed. There was a point in his life where he surrounded himself with young girls, sometimes very young girls. And we also see, interestingly, that even though we recognize Twain for his incredible sense of humor and actually for his humanistic expression, he harbored a kind of gloomy concept of the human race.
And my understanding, well, you can read the book to find that out, because that sort of emerged later in his life, right?
Yes.
And a lot of what came out. I've read an excerpt of the book. It's absolutely tremendous. He's such a great writer.
He really is.
And to command your attention for so many pages is really a feat, and he certainly accomplishes it. Mark Twain is the name of the book. Ron Chernow is the author, and it is out today. All right, James.
Kind of good timing, too, with the Twain with James getting all of the
Pulitzer, the Pulitzer Prize. Yes.
It's a good time for him to be.
Yes, good point.
Twain again. Okay, I'm going to start off with my version of a Final Jeopardy question for you all.
Oh, yay.
Yes, the category's authors.
Yep.
This author who died nearly 5 years ago is still one of my store's top sellers and just came out with a new book.
Oh.
Joan Didion.
Oh, Joan Didion.
Oh, yeah. Joan. Oh,
okay. And now I feel like an idiot because I'm reading this book right now. Oh, that. Yes.
I was just talking to somebody the other day about this book, and I was just sort of saying how she's still publishing. You know, and anyways,
her estate is still publishing.
Well, yes. But, you know, here we are 5 years later. We got a new book.
I'm about halfway through this. This is well, I mean, it's hard to say you enjoy it because there are torturous moments in it, but God, is it great to read.
It is, and it's also, what it is it's her Notes to John is the title of the book, and it's she saw a psychiatrist for a few years starting in 1999, and she recorded her notes to her husband, John Gregory Dunn, as sort of a way to, you know, I think make sure she got it all down so that she could discuss it with him later and all of that. But I think that's just also how her mind works. She just, to her, I think thinking is writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and solving problems in her life is that way. She was going through a lot of depression at the time. Her daughter, Quintana, was struggling with alcoholism and mental illness. She, of course, died 5 years later. The book reads just like her essays in the intellect and in the sort of artful writing. Maybe it's a little more casual because they are just therapy sessions, so you don't quite have, you know, the very exacting writing of her, but it's still the same spirit. And we're kind of going through a flurry of Joan Didion books right now. It started in the fall with Didion Babbitt's the duo biography with her relationship with Babbitt's. Yeah. And then in March there was a wonderful book that came out called Alyssa Wilkerson published. We Tell Ourselves Stories, Joan Didion and the American Dream Machine. And this chronicled Didion's life in California when she was pursuing screenplay writing and meeting a lot of Hollywood mogul people.
Mm-hmm.
This is also, this winter, 364 boxes of her writing went from her estate to the New York Public Library. So this is kind of a part of that, too, where I think a lot of things are going to be coming out from her that we haven't really seen before. And there was a bit of a controversy about this book because she wrote a very famous essay about questioning why we were publishing every scrap of paper that Hemingway ever wrote. And she was very adamant about this, that she thought this was kind of tarnishing an author by going so much after everything they ever wrote to publish. And the executors of her estate decided that this book should be published, though, because she had so carefully put all this in chronological order in a folder and left it in her desk. And it seemed like she put some importance on this, that this was something that meant a lot to her as well, so they didn't have an issue with publishing it. But anyways, we'll see if there's anything else that's going to come out in the public soon, more Joan Didion.
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense to it, though, at moments that you're reading something that maybe you shouldn't be reading.
Yeah.
You know, like it's you're reading somebody's diary.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating, and again, the language is gorgeous. Lily.
I will now talk about Warhol's Muses by Lawrence Lehmer. Lawrence Lehmer was also the author of the book Capote's Women. And now he's written about this group of women who served as the artistic muses for Andy Warhol and were very key in his becoming the super successful art icon that we know him as. He shows how Warhol cultivated this group of attractive, socially connected young women who not only inspired and starred in his legendary film, but also gave him emotional support until they were no longer of use to him when he discarded them. So these were pretty complex, intriguing women who had their own artistic ambitions. But he manipulated them using their beauty and their talent for his art and his social status with little concern for their safety even, let alone their dignity. Probably the most famous of these is on the jacket of the book, and that's Edie Sedgwick. She's the one that's been most written about, a woman who came from an old money family, had a troubled youth, and by the time she arrived in New York and came into Warhol's orbit, he really glommed onto her. And eventually, you know, it was a pretty dark time in New York, a lot of drugs, and she was a pretty vulnerable young woman. She became a heroin addict. She was institutionalized. Eventually, she came too late to understand how she'd been taken advantage of. So we also learn that these women that he called his superstars did often surrender their own artistic ambitions in service to, you know, helping Andy create his persona. A deep dive and research went into this book. Lemur had several interviews with former assistants of Andy Warhol's. He read all the transcriptions of Andy Warhol's tapes, and I found it mesmerizing and also really depressing that these women had such productive lives themselves, but they really fell under his sway. And, you know, it's interesting and sad at the same time.
The name of the book is Warhol's Muses by Lawrence Lemur. James.
My next book is The Lost Voice, a memoir by Greta Morgan. Music lovers will know Greta Morgan as a singer-songwriter of Hush Sound and was later a member of Vampire Weekend. And she was performing with Vampire Weekend in 2020 when she got a severe case of COVID, which was at the very start of the epidemic. And her COVID, unfortunately, was the type that was the long COVID and which she's still in treatment for, which ultimately can have consequences on your voice. And in her case, it had an extreme effect on her voice, and it completely affected her upper register, and she lost her ability to sing. And her musical creativity depended a lot on her singing. She'd use her voice sort of like as a way to sort out her ideas and her emotions in the songwriting. And when suddenly she couldn't use her voice while doing this, it totally affected her life and her livelihood. And she spent a long time feeling like a stranger in her own body with this. But she started to pay more attention to listening, and she developed an appreciation of how to relearn listening to music that had always been really integral in her life. But she also started to listen to the natural world. And she started this in the surroundings of the Southwest of America, and then now in the Catskills, where she lives now. She found this new way of listening as a way to develop her changed voice within her art as well. And she compares her new sort of shake in her voice to the elements of the wilderness and to actually animal sounds that are within it that she studied. And she's writing songs again, aware of this, and also writing prose. And her memoir is the result of this. It's just wonderful. And it comes out a week from today. But I'm bringing her up because we're part of the launch of her book at the Gold Notebook. And you can pre-order signed copies through our website. And join us on May 20th at the Pines in Mount Temper. And for a wonderful event with her to celebrate it, and contact our store for more information.
Excellent. And it's The Lost Voice by Greta Morgan.
And she's wonderful, too.
Lily.
Next up, I have The Secret Life of a Cemetery by Benoit Galot. I was so excited to dive into this book because I am a person who loves to wander through cemeteries. I find them fascinating. I love to read the headstones. They're peaceful places. They're often beautiful places, and they have a lot of old trees, which I'm also a huge fan of. So Benoit Galot is the head curator of the most famous cemetery in the world, which is the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. The subtitle of this book is The Wild Nature and Enchanting Lore of Père Lachaise. And many centuries of Parisians are buried in Père Lachaise, and surprisingly, 3,000 more are buried there every year. And this cemetery draws about 3.5 million visitors every year. And that's largely due to the fact that, yes, it's interesting and historic in and of itself, but so many famous people are buried there. A short list would include Chopin, Oscar Wilde, Edith Piaf, Gertrude Stein, Sarah Bernhardt, Richard Wright, and of course, the most visited grave, say it with me, Jim Morrison.
Sure.
So Gallo became the head curator of the cemetery in 2018, which coincided with this new city initiative, this Paris initiative for pesticides-free ground maintenance in public parks and areas. And once this had been implemented, there was this shockingly robust flourishing of wildflowers and all sorts of plants and a lot of wildlife. Foxes, lots of cats, martens, owls, birds, bees, butterflies. And during the pandemic, Gallo started an Instagram account where he would post all these amazing photographs of all this wildlife and foliage and, you know, flowers. And it developed like a I had no idea about this. And now, of course, I'm following him. But his photographs are beautiful of all this gorgeous nature. It's very worth checking out. But he's also a little bit of a philosophical, takes a little bit of a philosophical approach to it, because, of course, this is, you know, a place of death. But then you've got juxtaposed with this all this resurgence of life and vitality. I absolutely loved it.
Well, good stuff. The name of the book is The Secret Life of a Cemetery. James.
My next book is Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning by Peter Beinart. Peter Beinart has had a long career on the issue of Israel and Palestine. Dating back to 2000, he was one of the America's biggest defenders of Israel. But over time, he has broken a lot with these beliefs, and now he argues that Israel as a state cannot be both Jewish and democratic, and he believes that Palestinian refugees must be allowed to return to their historic Palestine. And this book uses Jewish texts to make his case, as well as lessons from South Africa, where his family is originally from, which chronicles how that country confronted its apartheid. And the book also has chapters that talk directly about what is happening today on college campuses and about how Jewish students can have some trouble understanding what certain values of Israel can look like to Palestinians and how they could engage better with each other. And it's this kind of hope with education that carries through to the end of the book, where Beinart hopes for Israeli Jews and Palestinians to live together in full equality, which is an idea that he's not sure he'll ever see in his lifetime. But he believes that hope is like oxygen, and that hope is also like his belief in God. And I'm talking about his book today because we're actually a part of an event with him tonight at 7 p.m. at the Jewish Woodstock Congregation. Beinart's going to be in conversation about all this with Rabbi Jonathan Kligler. And it's part of a wider program the Jewish Woodstock Congregation is having about Israel and Palestine, and it's co-sponsored by Jewish Currents. So come tonight at 7 o'clock if you're around and hear more about this.
Tonight at 7 o'clock, Peter Beinart is the author, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Lily.
Well, this title sort of, this book sort of that I'm going to talk about sort of brushes up against what you're talking about. And it's called I Seek a Kind Person, My Father, Seven Children, and the Adverts That Helped Them Escape the Holocaust by Julian Borger. Borger is a British journalist, and in this book he tells the story of how Austrian children were saved from certain death at the hands of the Nazis with the help of newspaper ads. The book is based on his very personal search for answers after his father, Robert, died by suicide in 1983. He remembered a family story of how his grandparents had placed an ad in an English newspaper in 1938 in the hope of finding their son a new home in England, away from the growing threat of the Nazis. Borger managed to locate that ad, and he was surprised to find other similar ads from other Jewish families in Vienna who were also desperate to get their kids to safety. And this book records these stories he was able to piece together about a handful of these children. And, of course, reading these stories, you're reminded of the risks that parents driven to desperation will take to save their kids. I mean, literally giving them up to strangers in a foreign country. The survivor stories reflect the lifelong trauma of separation and have having to flee on their own as children. There's also resilience and strength, but also a lot of depression, anxiety, and survivor's guilt. You know, one of the tragedies of the Holocaust, which, you know, how can you... Every aspect of it is a tragedy, but so many personal histories and family histories were completely lost. But Borger does an amazing job of salvaging these particular stories, which are threads, pretty remarkable threads that connect the present to a dark past, but also to the will to survive.
The name of the book is I Seek a Kind Person by Julian Borger. James.
Actually, I read a really great article about that book. I'm really excited to read it.
Yeah.
It looked really good.
Yeah.
My next book, we'll switch gears here, Harriet Tubman, Live in Concert by Bob the Drag Queen. Bob the Drag Queen was the season 8 winner of RuPaul's Drag Race. I don't think I need to explain what RuPaul's Drag Race is, do I?
No.
I just always check. But I presume it's now
you're good.
The meta consciousness.
You're safe.
Okay. I'd also like to argue that Bob is one of the most famous of that show's discoveries and certainly one of the funniest queens that RuPaul has ever put on the international stage. And Bob's now written a novel, and as the title gives away, Harriet Tubman has returned to life, as well as some other historical figures like Cleopatra and Rockefeller. And she's contacted Darnell, a once very successful hip-hop producer, to help her and four slaves that she has freed, and who now make up her band, to create an album and a live show about her life. Hamilton is obviously her inspiration. And when I heard about this novel coming out, I looked up some early reviews to see if it would be good, and I was mainly curious about how the humor of performance drag was going to translate to the written word. And I found my answer in one particularly not-so-good review, which I wasn't going to reveal the source, but it was Kirkus. And the reviewer, first of all, he complained that the author gives no explanation for how these historical figures just come back to life. And to which I just had to think, well, what explanation would the author give you that would satisfy you? And then he also complained that the author was belittling some very serious subjects. For example, the hip-hop producer, Darnell, he makes a comparison about how did the slaves patiently wait so long to be freed when he didn't even have the patience to sit through a YouTube commercial. And I knew when I read all this that Bob had actually succeeded in bringing drag to the page at this point, because drag humor is based on absurdity and extremes, and this bad review kind of highlighted these exact qualities of the novel. So for those of you who appreciate that kind of over-the-top extreme of drag expression, you're going to love Bob the Drag Queen's novel, Harriet Tubman Live in Concert. So we could use a little drag humor right now, I think.
Harriet Tubman Live in Concert by Bob the Drag Queen. All right, Lily.
More nonfiction. In fact, my whole list is nonfiction. I swear I didn't plan it that way, but
I have a lot, too. Yeah,
it's yeah.
Anyway, here we are. Good.
My next book is The Last Great Dream, How Bohemians Became Hippies and Created the 60s by Dennis McNally. The name Dennis McNally may be familiar to some. He was a publicist for the Grateful Dead for many years, and he previously wrote a biography of the band called A Long Strange Trip. In this latest book, he gives an in-depth overview of the 1950s and 1960s bohemianism, which essentially is the post-World War II countercultural movement. And since few cities represent that more than San Francisco, he begins by tracing how a group of modern poets in late 1940s San Francisco overlapped with the art, theater, music, and activist movements in L.A., New York, and London. So we see a lot of familiar characters. We see Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. We see the Beatles and the Jefferson Airplane. We see the social transformation in Haight-Ashbury, which was, we see it as the social experiment that it was, where mostly young people were reconsidering aspects of American identity, mainstream values like consumerism and militarism, also misogyny, and they were opting in favor of creativity and peace and a focus on love. And I just want to say, it's easy to look back at that time and those people with a sort of jaundiced sarcasm, maybe even, or skewering. But I was listening to Elvis Costello the other day, and I just want to say, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Right.
Am I right? So the characters he writes about are drawn from everything from the pop music world to high art. He also discusses about how around the world governments have historically suppressed bohemians by censorship, by cracking down on free speech. Anyway, McNally creates a really immersive read that combines all these threads of the political, the social, art, and pop history into one big sweeping cohesive picture. It's a pretty stunning vision of the powerful idealism that took hold for about 20 years.
I am sorry to say we are out of time. So if you go to our website, you can see all of the other books that our booksellers have come to share with us this morning. Lily Bartels, James Conrad, thank you so much for being here. It's always wonderful to have you. You can find out more information by going to their websites, goldennotebook.com or opendoor-bookstore.com, or on our website, wamc.org/roundtable.